I'm going to read something from the Pali Canon to introduce tonight's talk, but it just occurred to me during the break that this is the Middle Length Sayings, first volume, and it was given to me when I ordained. It was an original part of my requisites. So thank you to the Sangha, it's 20 years old. So in the last live talk I gave, it was based on the theme of meditation being like driving a car. And I so loved the theme of transport that I thought I'd give it another go this evening. So tonight we'll be looking at the Buddha's parable of the raft. Yes, it's such a lovely teaching. The whole of the Buddha's teaching is so gentle and yet so deeply profound. There's a specific reason that the Buddha taught this parable of the raft, but for me it goes further than it was originally intended to be, and is a wonderful description of the whole teaching, in essence. So I thought it would be nice to go through it. So I will read this slowly, because obviously for some people it'll be the first time you've ever heard it, and it might be not too easy to put it all together, although it's not a particularly complicated parable. So the Buddha is talking to the monks, and he gives this parable. I'll teach you Dhamma, that's the Buddha's teaching. I'll teach you Dhamma, the parable of the raft, for crossing over, not for retaining. Listen to it, pay careful attention, and I will speak. Yes, Lord, these monks answered, the Lord in assent. Monks, as a man going along a highway might see a great stretch of water, the hither bank dangerous and frightening, the further bank secure, not frightening. But if there were not a boat for crossing by, or a bridge across for going from the near shore to the far shore, this might occur to him. This is a great stretch of water, the hither bank dangerous and frightening, the further bank secure and not frightening. But there is not a boat for crossing by, or a bridge across for going from the near shore to the far shore. Suppose that I, having collected grass, sticks, branches and foliage, and having tied a raft, depending on that raft, and striving with hands and feet, should cross over safely to the beyond. Then, monks, that man, having collected grass and sticks, branches and foliage, having tied a raft, depending on that raft, and striving with his hands and feet, might cross over safely to the beyond. To him, crossed over, gone beyond, this might occur. Now this raft has been very useful to me. I, depending on this raft, and striving with my hands and feet, crossed over safely to the beyond. Suppose now that I, having put this raft on my head, and having lifted it onto my shoulder, should proceed as I desire. What do you think about this, monks? If that man does this, is he doing what should be done with that raft? No, Lord. What should that man do, monks, in order to do what should be done with the raft? In this case, monks, it might occur to that man who has crossed over, gone beyond. Now this raft has been very useful to me. Depending on this raft and striving with my hands and feet, I have crossed over safely to the beyond. Suppose now that I, having beached this raft on dry ground, or having submerged it under water, should proceed as I desire. In doing this, monks, that man would be doing what should be done with that raft. Even so, monks, is the parable of the raft, Dhamma taught by me for crossing over, not for retaining. You monks, by understanding the parable of the raft, should get rid even of right mental objects, all the more wrong ones. So tonight I'd just like to use that parable. First, though, we have to contextualize it. The Buddha used this parable on a number of occasions. You find it in various places in the Pali Canon. But it's always offered when there has been disputes with regard to what the teaching actually is, what is right view, what is wrong view, people picking up the teaching in the wrong way and then disputing about it with others, claiming they've got the truth and other people have got it wrong. So the Buddha is using it as a way of putting it across to people that this teaching isn't a set of beliefs that you must adhere to and blindly accept. Rather, it is utilitarian. It is something that you use once it has fulfilled its purpose. You let it all go. That's one of the key reasons I started practicing Buddhism. It's not a teaching of, I'm going to say something flash here, it's not a teaching of vicarious atonement. It's not a teaching of being saved by somebody else or something else. It's not a religion. It is a teaching wherein we are given the tools we need to come to our own perfect comprehension and understanding of life, and in so doing, we release ourselves from suffering, because all suffering is based on a misapprehension of reality. Yes, a mistaken apprehension of reality, which causes us to misperceive the world and believe the world is one thing, when in actual fact, it isn't like that at all. And so the purpose of the Buddha's teaching is to give us the tools we need in order to, as it were, cross this stretch of water to reach the safety of a further shore. So the reason I say that the Buddha's teaching is so gentle is that if you understand that, you couldn't possibly use this teaching as a way of trying to browbeat people or trying to prove your rightness and their wrongness at all, because it's all about utilizing these elements of the teaching in order to come to your own comprehension of life and you let the world go free. So that's why the Buddha would use this, it seems to me anyway, that this is why the Buddha would use this parable of the raft. It's beautiful in the sense that it's so reassuring to know that you're not expected to just blindly believe what you're told, that everything in this teaching is realizable through your own mindful observation of experience. That's so very, very powerful. You do have to have faith, but faith is a very positive quality. It's not the same thing as blind belief at all. Faith is having confidence in what you're doing. And we'll come on to this because we're going to have to launch the raft, so we're going to have the confidence in setting sail across this. I always think of it as a sea. It doesn't say it's a sea at all. It just says a great stretch of water. But I always imagine it as this very turbulent sea of suffering that we somehow got to navigate. But anyway, so yes, yeah, so we're going to have faith. We're going to have lots of different qualities. But what I thought we could look at tonight was, what do we mean by the near shore? We've almost already covered that, really. How do we make the raft? How do we calm the sea as much as we can to make it as pleasant a journey across the expanse of waters we can? Why might it be that we're unable to launch? What might be holding us back? What do we do with leaks in the raft? There's a lot to get through. Actually, what does crossing the sea actually entail? How we can utilize the guiding light of a teacher who's perhaps already crossed that sea. Mistaking what is not the far shore for the far shore. And then describing as best we can the far shore when we finally get there. So there's a lot to get through. So come on, we've got to be about our business. So we've touched on the nearshore. So there are beings running hither and thither on the near shore, all trying to find freedom from suffering, all ignoring the true causes of suffering, trying somehow to make life work in some ultimately fulfilling way, only to find that even if you have all your dreams come true, that means that all your dreams have come to an end and you need some more dreams. It's a never-ending process. And in it we suffer. There's grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair. Being united with things that we do not love and losing the things that we do love and being unable to get the things that we want. We all know this. That's 99.99% recurring percent of all human beings go through this. And in terms of the Buddha's teaching, we know that this is an endless process. So every now and then, one of those 99.99% recurring percent of human beings thinks to themselves, there has to be an answer to this. And it doesn't lie in just doing more of the same thing. And that's where perhaps they begin to wake up to this idea that maybe there's more to life than we had hitherto appreciated. And maybe something like the Buddha's teaching will help. So we have, the Buddha gives us this idea of this near shore of suffering and then the far shore, which is freedom from suffering. And we want to make our way across. So I literally put all this in very big font, but I still need my glasses. Yeah, making the raft. So obviously we're going to have to get the equivalent of all this grass and sticks and branches and so forth. What is the raft made of? The raft is made of what we call the five spiritual faculties. I don't want this to be just like endless list making, but it is really useful. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and investigation. The things that we develop to make our meditation lovely and strong. Faith, as I mentioned before, confidence in what we're doing. Energy is balanced energy. Knowing what's too much, knowing what's too little, learning through experience, what's the right level of energy in order to explore our conscious experience. Mindfulness, which is overseeing the whole process. Concentration, which is the ability to focus our attention on the things that really matter and let go of peripheral things. And investigation, or what I like to call exploring. Developing this capacity to explore with interest, with delight, what's actually taking place in our experience. Learning not to turn away just because it's something that doesn't seem to be terribly nice. Learning to look at things closely, observing them, coming to understand them as they're unfolding. So those are the five qualities that our raft is made of. And how do we bring those five qualities together? We bring them together through things like generosity, service, there's another list, of 10 qualities called the parami. Well worth learning the 10 by heart. I don't know why I'm putting on my glasses, I've learned them to heart. Generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving-kindness and equanimity. Through serving others, we're reducing our own attachment to our own self-regard and we're turning our attention outward to what perhaps other people need. That's helping to generate all those qualities within us. Those qualities then mature into these spiritual faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and investigation. So obviously that includes meditating and learning how to meditate and getting good at meditating. But if meditation is supported by the development of these parami, then you're going to find yourself a very sturdy raft. I do have to point out here that a question might usefully be asked. How sturdy does your raft have to be? some spiritual, some Buddhist teachings suggest that you have to go so far in building your raft that it'll be more appropriate to call it an ocean liner. I personally couldn't wait that long, because you're talking rebirths. For me, it just had to get me across. It just had to be adequate. That's all. It just has to be adequate. You do not have to turn yourself into the most amazing spiritual being of all time. In fact, you never will, because obviously that was the Buddha. And you're not going to be more amazing than him. So you don't have to become this larger than life spiritual being. You just have to be all right. You just have to be like quite nice. Honestly, they'll get you across, really. So we've got our adequate transport. We've got our raft. It is possible to calm the sea. I mean, it's like I'm going with the sea. If there are storms all the time, if it's just really rough all the time, then no, your raft isn't going to be good enough to get you across. But you can calm the sea. How do you calm the sea? Keeping the precepts. Calm the sea by keeping the precepts. There will be far fewer storms in your life, taking you away from meditation, you know, having to deal with that court case, having to, you know, spend 10 years in Wormwood Scrubs or whatever. Dependent on what you had in mind, obviously. Some people get a bit doubtful about the precepts. They like the odd drink or whatever. And okay, that's fine. The way I like to put it across is that they're training precepts. It's undertaking the training precept to refrain from. They're not commandments from God. They're just training precepts. So you do the best you can with where you're at, always knowing that as this training develops, as your mindfulness increases, your understanding of what actions lead to what results grows. And as a natural consequence of that, you tend towards keeping the precepts more and more. You just naturally tend towards them because your wisdom is growing, you're developing your mindfulness and your ability to see that actually meditation is more challenging after you've had a few too many drinks. But that always leaves the door open for, say, a social situation where perhaps having a glass of wine with your meal is probably the socially acceptable thing to do, that's the right thing to do, and that glass of wine could keep you going all evening. So, you know, you haven't done anything terribly wrong there. This flexibility, this ability to adapt to circumstances is the hallmark of meditation. So you can calm the sea to a certain extent. I mean, who knows what we've done in the past and in the long past. And it only requires the right supporting conditions to emerge, and you've got a storm. And you might think, well, I've been really good. I kept the precepts and I practiced meditation. I do my loving kindness. Why is this storm going on? It's because something you did in a past life is just the right supporting conditions have emerged. But you'll get over it. Unable to launch. So there you are. You've started moving your raft through the sea, but you've launched it at night, or maybe trying to get a head start. And then sunrise comes up and you realize you've gone nowhere because the raft is still tethered to the near shore. What stops people? Doubt. The major one, isn't it? Doubt. I'll do it once I've got all the answers to all my questions. Then I'll actually set sail. But it doesn't work like that. You find out through actually undertaking the training. Remember, no one is asking anyone to blindly believe anything. But if you want to realize freedom from suffering, you've got to get going, which means you've got to take yourself in hand and say, no, I'm going to commit to it. I'm going to go. I'm going to do this. And I'll find out along the way. Apart from anything else, that makes it a proper adventure. I did think of the people setting sail to the New World all those hundreds of years ago, and what that must have felt like. And an adventure. And this is an amazing adventure. It's not an adventure through space, is it? It's an adventure of ever deepening unfolding of the hidden truths about life through simply learning to pay proper attention to what's actually going on. It's a marvelous teaching, and it's a marvelous journey. And you know that I'm always trying to encourage taking an interest in exploration, in discovery, not assuming, and that requires faith. That's why faith is so important. Other things that might prevent us being able to launch is just like really strong attachment to stuff, which is the whole point, is to free ourselves from those attachments. And of course that brings up fear as well. But I think for anyone who has gone around the track enough times, consciously recognize that these problems, the problem of suffering, is not getting resolved, and perhaps forgetting and it all going foggy again and trying again with something else. And eventually the fog lifts and you go, oh, I was going to follow a spiritual path. Eventually, if you go around that track enough times, something goes so deep inside that you go, no, I've just got to do it this time. I've just got to. And you set sail, no matter what. Leaks in the raft. Hindrances. So you do all this work of being nice to people and helping people and being kind and supportive. And you set sail across the sea of suffering, and you've got leaks in your boat, in your raft. And we don't want those. So when we practice hindrances, those are the times when we want life to be different than it is. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, worry and flurry, and doubt. They're like holes in our raft. We gain all this unwanted seawater and lose all the good qualities that we've been developing as we just lose ourselves into these hindrances. But that's why we're practicing. That's the first part of the practice, always. It's in being inclusive of these unwanted mental formations, allowing them in, letting them be there, and observing them mindfully. Come to a better understanding of them, come to a better understanding of the processes that unfold. We're developing that wisdom that understands, say, sensual desire as sensual desire. And you will see how the sensual desire is like this flow. It's like flowing, like the mind and mental energy flowing into these thoughts and feelings about what you want, and how life will be so perfect if you have this. I'm thinking of a siren song, you know, the song of the siren, tempting the sailors with all this beautiful music, and you think, if only I could possess that siren, then I would be truly happy. And so we know what happens to the poor sailors that get caught by the siren song. They come to their end. And so we have to learn, we have to allow that whole process of sensual desire to unfold in order to see that it never actually produces what we wanted. It actually produces the opposite. We end up feeling a bit ashamed of ourselves and a bit worn out with it all, and we still feel dissatisfied. And so over time we gain this knowledge, this understanding of the hindrances, of where they truly lead. And we naturally let go. We naturally abandon the clinging to those particular thought forms. It's a very natural process. So they're the things that always get in the way. They're the things that always interrupt our meditative journey. So we want to know about them. We want to understand them. Crossing the sea I can't bring in another metaphor. I was going to start talking about submarines, and I realised that was probably not helpful in the circumstances. But really what we're talking about is a deepening understanding of conscious experience. When we set aside hindrances, when we learn all about them and understand them, and we can let them go, we find there is this beautiful, deep space, mental space that we occupy, which is what's unfolding. And in that space, there is sounds and there are tactile sensations. If it's non-meditative, then there's shape and color, there's seeing, there's tasting, there's smelling as well. And of course, there's everything that's going on in mind. And we discover that there is this, I'm really going with the metaphors tonight, there is the sea of phenomena that is what is, which is actually what's unfolding. Consciousness, perceptions, feelings, mental formations, materiality. Everything that's unfolding right now is the coming together of what we call the aggregates. So we've set aside the hindrances, clear, we're looking at what's actually here, we see that there is this sea of phenomena. And we can note all the components that go to make up this sea of phenomena. We can note a moment of materiality, a moment of consciousness, a moment of perception, a moment of feeling. We can note mental formations arising. Craving, desire, irritability, tranquility, equanimity, happiness, memory. And this is where the process of meditation becomes really so profound, because we start to recognize that we've never stopped to actually look at any of this. We can look at this experience that's unfolding right now in two different ways. We can look at it through a conventional lens, or we can look at it through the lens of the ultimates. And from a conventional point of view, it's pretty known. We know that we're in the Shrine Room in Bradford and Avon. We know it's a Wednesday night. Yeah, we kind of know all that. When we look at the same things unfolding in ultimate terms, we see shape and color. We see there is seeing, there is perception, there is feeling. And we realize we've never actually looked at life like this. And it's such a rewarding exercise. Because the more we look, the more we see that everything is unfolding in this impersonal flow. That if there is hearing, it's not me that's making that hearing happen. That hearing is just happening. If there's thinking, thoughts arise spontaneously. There is no thinker who thinks the thought. There is just the arising of the thought and the knowing of the thought. This is a beautiful, beautiful thing to begin to comprehend, because it starts to chip away at the roots of the causes of suffering. We crave because we think there's something substantial there that we can own and control and have, and that thing will make us happy. And the more we see how transient, uncontrollable, unsatisfactory, conditioned everything that arises actually is, that desire, that craving just gradually gets knocked away more and more. And in the absence of the craving, there is this delightful depth of peace and bliss and happiness, which is our true nature. Sounds right, doesn't it? So that's why we practice Vipassana meditation. It's getting rid of the craving. It's not getting rid of life. It's not getting rid of things, but it is seeing through the appearance of things and seeing that the things of the world are indeed ephemeral, that they're not the thing we thought they were. It is so much more dreamlike. It is so much more ephemeral in reality. There are many difficulties to be overcome along the way. Some people get confused. They mistake what is not the far shore, what is not the cessation of suffering, to be the cessation of suffering because it shares some of the hallmarks. So, for instance, many years ago now, there was a lady who came to see me who claimed that she was enlightened. We had a discussion and I asked her a series of questions about it. And what became obvious was that actually she kept precepts, she practiced loving kindness meditation, and for long periods of time, as far as she couldn't remember the last time she particularly ran a hindrance. And so she had, in some way, shape or form, concluded that that meant that she must be enlightened. And as often is the case, and not that this happens often, but when this sort of thing happens, it only ever goes one of two ways. Either the person accepts what I tell them, or they don't. And if they don't, we don't tend to see them much anymore. And in this case, we didn't see this person anymore, which is a shame. The analogy I use for these kinds of things is like it's like you're on your raft, you're crossing the sea. The sea is lovely and calm, and then you come to the shore. The raft alights on the shore. You get off. You look around you and go, well, this must be the far shore that they keep talking about. This must be it. It's got all the signs of, look, there are pebbles, there's some sand, there's the ice cream vendor. It must be. I must be there. And so they believe that that's where they've got to. So there is no more need to do any more meditation. There is no need to put yourself in that situation. So I liken it to, like, perhaps one of two things happens. Either they wander through that land, they walk around the shoreline and end up back where they alighted and realize that they're on an island and it's not the far shore that they thought it was. Or the sea of suffering starts to rise to such a point that it actually swamps the island that they're on, and they're forced either way to get back on their raft or create a new raft and carry on their way. Eventually, the suffering causes somebody back on the straight and narrow, and they're forced to give up that conceit. This is why it's so important that we have a guiding light. This is why it's so important that we recognize the validity of having a guide, of having a teacher, of being willing to put ourselves in the situation of developing the relationship with the teacher so that the teacher can help us stop from falling into these kinds of errors. I'm minded of the fact that in the parable of the raft, the Buddha talks about how when you have completed the training, when you've got to the far shore, you don't need the teaching anymore. You are free. You don't have to meditate if you don't want to. You don't even have to uphold the Dhamma if you don't want to. You're not going to do anything that would require you to be reborn as a human being again. You're free. However, there are some people that tarry on the far shore and call us, and they're our teachers. And of course, the primary teacher was the Buddha himself. And I don't know if you know the story of after the Buddha became enlightened, he was reluctant to teach because of the vexation of trying to put this across to people. Brahma Sahampati is a Deva who came down to see the Buddha and urged the Buddha to teach, because although it was vexing and difficult and challenging, there were those that would understand. There were those with little dust in their eyes who would otherwise die without ever knowing the truth, who, if the Buddha taught, then they would be able to see. They would come to know and understand. And so the Buddha taught on that basis. It was purely out of compassion. He didn't want anything from it at all. So what is the far shore like? There is nothing that you can say about it. So, lovely to see you. But we have to try, of course. It's very difficult to put across. It's not peace. It's not ease. It's not tranquility. It's not joy. All these things do arise. But Nibbana is not any of those things. Because I don't know if you've noticed, those things arise and pass away. Joy arises and passes away. Ease, peace, happiness, equanimity, all arise and pass away. Nibbana is the unconditioned. It is not created. It neither arises nor passes away. It is blissful in the sense of being signless. Anything that has a sign has the nature to arise and pass away. See, there's nothing you can say about Nibbana. All you can talk about are the kinds of things which are conditioned by the realization of Nibbana. You can describe those things, but you have to understand that none of those things are Nibbana. But then neither are they not. I hope that clears it up for you. So there is, to put it in terms, all of which are untrue, there is this magnificent, unbelievable depth to life. There is this magnificent, unbelievable silence behind everything. Life is dreamlike. It's not solid or serious. And yet we relate to it as though it were. So we get to dance the dance of life, knowing that none of it matters. We just choose to take it seriously. But there's always a lightness, there's always a sense of underlying bliss, for the very reason that it's just all appearances. The Buddha said, "This truly is peaceful, this is sublime." That is to say, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the ending of craving, cessation, Nibbana.